How often do you stop and consider your mind? Not the squishy stuff under your skull, but the conscious you who likes ice cream and Johnny Cash songs and the feeling of falling in love. That mind. That you. Well, this hour we consider just that, the mystery of consciousness, how the flimsy stuff of mind emerges from matter. I'm Veronica Rickert with you this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is WPR Steve Paulson. You may know him as the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge. He has been a contributing writer for Salon, Slate, and the Huffington Post, and his work has been heard on NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And he's with us this hour to talk about the new six-part series he just produced for TT Book called Meet Your Mind. And we welcome your questions and comments for Steve this hour at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org or chime in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Steve Paulson, thanks for being here.
Hi, Veronica. It's great to be here.
So I spent a few days with this material. You, on the other hand, have spent years up to your neck in this stuff.
That is very true.
And just from my few days with it, it's trippy stuff. You really have to kind of stop a lot and digest. I mean,
you want to try to wrap your head around it, and it is very hard to, because it's all about your head. So it's very hard to wrap your head around
it. That's why your head is looking larger these days. Well, how would you sum up, for those of us who aren't as deep in it as you are, how would you sum up the crux of this mystery of consciousness?
Well, just to back up for a moment, one of the reasons why I got so interested in this whole subject of consciousness is it really gets to one of the deepest questions in all of science. I mean, if I had to sort of, having interviewed lots of scientists and philosophers of science, if you've had to find like the two hardest questions in science, one would probably be, how did the universe start? You know, how did something come out of nothing? And the other would be consciousness. What's the relationship between the mind and the brain? And I mean, sort of the crux of the difficulty is here. You know, we know that the brain is incredibly complicated. There are scientists now think there are close to 100 billion neurons, trillions of synapses. Mm. I mean, just some people say it's the most complex object ever discovered in the universe. So you have this amazing thing, the human brain, and somehow out of this comes our mind, our mental experience. But if you think about our thoughts, our feelings, our sense of self-awareness, it's not made of anything. You know, you can't measure a thought. You can't weigh it. It eludes science. And so that is this huge question, which is, what's the connection between all the stuff in the brain and then in our mental experience, consciousness?
Well, it's also important because all that stuff you just talked about overlaps with spiritual experience, religious experience, and people who will say that what you are describing as consciousness is another word for the soul. And so can you prove it with science? If so, you know, maybe that's bad news.
Well, and that's actually how I got into this subject, because I did a series for TT Book a few years ago on science and religion. I ended up writing a book about it. And what I realized as I sort of dug into, you know, the conflicts between science and religion, I think the biggest intellectual challenge there, the discussion, is about consciousness. I mean, everyone sort of talks about evolution. That's politically in our public sphere, you know, that's where the debate is. But intellectually, the far more interesting question is consciousness. It's strictly this question of, what's the connection between the brain and the mind? And a lot of people with a spiritual orientation or a religious orientation would say, you'll never be able to explain the mind through the brain. You know, if you think about the religious implications of this, I mean, if we really can communicate with God, let's say, you have to assume, I think, that there is some dimension of consciousness that goes beyond someone's individual brain. And so it raises profound questions about the nature of consciousness there. And that's just one of many very interesting things.
Well, that's one camp. And then you've got the other camp that practically says they'll be able to pinpoint the exact neuron that will tell you it's responsible for the exact thought of this facet of you that you thought was just magical, wonderful you. But here it is, this particular neuron XYZ in your brain.
Right. And well, they would probably rephrase it slightly. They probably wouldn't say it would be an exact neuron, but they would say it would be a cluster of neurons, a sort of a particular collection of circuits, of connections of neurons and synapses, and that, yes, some you could isolate that and come up with particular thoughts, particular experiences, but so far no one has been able to prove that.
Well, we have a lot of clips that you brought in to give us a taste of just what this debate and the science sounds like right now, what we're thinking about. But we can also tell you that there is a 6-part series that you have produced for TT Book called Meet Your Mind. It has begun airing on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not finished yet, but why don't you tell us about what's there and how people can listen?
Sure. 6 hours on different aspects of the mind. One is on kind of this what has been called the mind-brain problem, what we've just been talking about. You know, what's the connection between the brain and the mind? It gets very philosophical. Another hour is on memory, which is endlessly fascinating. We can talk more about that later if you'd like. And memory and forgetting, you know, what happens as we recall a memory. Another hour has to do more with kind of the differences between the left hemisphere of the brain and the right hemisphere. And then we go on to talk about creativity in the brain and certain kinds of neurological disorders and some of the gifts that sometimes can come from, you know, what we can find from people like autistic savants. And anyway, it's fascinating stuff, and it's all on our website. So if people haven't actually heard some of the hours, it's on the website, ttbook.org, and we call the series Meet Your Mind, so it's ttbook.org/meetyourmind.
Well, I want to dig in. I want to listen to some of this, and one of the people that you've given us is a fellow named Daniel Dennett, and as I understand it, he's one of these guys who says, oh yeah, we're going to be able to crack the code on consciousness.
Right.
A little cocky.
Well, he is he's a renowned philosopher, a philosopher of science and a philosopher of mind, and he is what would be called a materialist. So yes, he thinks there's no great mystery here. And so we had an interesting conversation, sort of a friendly little quarrel, you might say, where we're talking about the nature of dreams, you know, one of those most ethereal kinds of things you can have. And let's listen.
Would you find it just unimaginable that science might in, the next 15 or 20 years, be able to read people's brains while they sleep and then write down what they're actually dreaming? Would you give me that kind of mind reading?
I don't think I
would.
We
can't do it yet, but we can do it a little bit.
I don't give you that, actually.
well, then hang on to your hat.
Okay.
Because that's coming. We can
You're saying science will be able to do that without any kind of self-reporting by the dreamer.
Oh, no. We'll use waking reports by dreamers, of course, to calibrate the instruments and understand how to decode the neural signals.
See, that's my point. That's my point. If you don't ask the person what they're dreaming, will you ever be able to decipher the dreams?
Well, let's build up to it then. So we ask the person what they're dreaming for 100 nights. And we build up a nice library, and we translate the relevant brain states for that person. Then the idea that one might then be able to say a little bit later, oh, look, Jones is having that dream about the old car, and look, he's falling over a cliff now. And we wake him up, and that's what he reports. If you think that's just beyond the reach of science, I think you're wrong.
But that's just correlation. That's just, you know, you're just looking at what so-and-so has dreamed, and you're just going to match the brain imaging to some future dream. That still doesn't explain how within the brain that particular kind of dream is generated.
Yeah, well, so then we have to do that too. But I think we're making good progress on that too. But we can't do that now. Might we do that in the future? Certainly.
Ah. I like how you were a little scrappy there, because some of what he was saying, I mean, it's astounding that in our present day of science, the tools that we have, that he is that confident is what we will be able to do in terms of nailing down conscious experiences.
Well, and what has happened, one of the reasons why consciousness is now on the map of science is because some of the new technologies that are out there, especially brain imaging technologies. And, you know, go back 30 years or so, and no one was studying the science of consciousness, no neuroscientist. It was considered just too difficult, too big a mystery. And then suddenly you had these tools that you could actually, you know, go into a living, breathing human being and, you know, put them in a brain scan machine and watch what was going on as they were thinking.
What does it look like, a brain? I mean, how does a brain scan machine work, actually?
I am the wrong person to go into great detail about that. But what you can see is you can see different parts of the brain light up during particular kinds of mental experiences. So, you know, you could ask someone to think about something and, you know, you can watch what will happen. Or one of the most amazing things is people are now putting musicians into brain scanning machines and actually, you know, asking them to make music. And you can actually see which parts of the brain light up. And there are differences between when they're improvising, for instance, versus when they are playing a more rehearsed piece. So, I mean, it really is. It's remarkable. It's kind of unlocking different parts of the brain. So what you can do, I mean, what Daniel Dennett is saying here is that we're developing much more sophistication to see which parts of the brain are active for particular kinds of experiences. Now, he's saying this will have, you know, with dreams, you could do this. But the thing is, it still comes back to you have to talk to the person and ask them, what were you dreaming? And so then you can, you could match, you know, what they say they were dreaming with the actual brain images. You know, this is complicated stuff. It still doesn't explain, though, why those particular brain, those particular dreams are generated. So there's the fundamental question of explanation here. And so, I mean, my point was, yes, you could correlate this stuff, but can you actually explain why those dreams, or, mm-hmm. you know, why a particular thought would pop in our head? That is a profound mystery.
But he's not alone in that. I know we've had other guests on this show who have said exactly that same thing, not with the emphasis on dreaming and consciousness, but who have said, oh, yes, it's part of the material world.
Right.
Therefore, the material world will be able to explain it. And they've been pretty confident about the odds of this.
Actually, there are two questions there. One is, I think the vast majority of neuroscientists would say, absolutely, it's the material world. Everything that happens in our mind is based on what goes on in the brain. That's the standard sort of neuroscience model. The next question is, can science explain this? And that gets a little tougher, and you'll get a lot of different perspectives on whether science can do that. And I mean, there's a fundamental problem here, because science is, it's all about, you know, what's often called kind of third-person reporting. You know, you have your measurements, your tests, and all of that. But the mind is subjective experience. So the question, the real question is, can science ever sort of, using the tools of science, can it ever explain subjective experience? And so that's sort of the crux of it here.
And one of the folks who says, yeah, probably not, is David Chalmers. Can you tell us a little about him?
Sure. David Chalmers is an Australian philosopher of mind, and he really set the parameters of this debate, back in about 1995 or so. He wrote this seminal essay on spelling out what he described as the easy problem of consciousness versus the hard problem of consciousness. He said some things that happen in our mind, we will be able to explain through brain function. And then he says the other stuff, especially sort of the feelings, the awareness, he thinks that that is beyond what the science, at least, that we know now can ever explain.
One of the big issues in the philosophy of the mind is, well, is the mind just the brain? I mean, is a physical processes enough to explain what's in your mind and what's in your consciousness? And I've been, you know, somewhat reluctantly led to the conclusion that, in fact, materialism doesn't have the resources to fully explain consciousness. I mean, the materialist view says basically there's a few fundamental properties in the world, space and time and mass and charge, and a few laws that connect them. And everything can ultimately be explained in terms of that. But when it comes to consciousness, this reductionist program doesn't succeed. So my own view is we should take something like consciousness as a primitive element of the world, a fundamental property, if you like, in the way that physics takes space and time and mass.
Now, that's fascinating. I mean, you're suggesting that consciousness may have its own fundamental property of nature, so to speak?
Basically, yes. Physics is meant to be a theory of everything, fundamental properties that explains everything. But if it turns out it doesn't, what we have to do as scientists is to expand our primitives.
A couple, I mean, a lot of interesting things to chew on there. But one thing I want to start with is he says we don't have the resources. And I wonder what he means by the resources to explain consciousness. Does he mean that we have not yet invented the technology that will allow us to do that, or that it's just somehow unknowable?
That's an interesting question. I think, yes, he has said we haven't developed the technology. I mean, there's an open question whether we ever can develop the technology. I mean, you know, what kinds of machines could you get that would somehow go into our brain and, you know, analyze those neural connections to explain why a thought or why a feeling pops up in our head? It's not at all clear that science will ever be able to explain that. There are some people, Chalmers is one of them, who says we actually need to redefine science. We basically need to develop a new paradigm for science to try to crack the problem of consciousness, which is somehow incorporating sort of the tools of brain science with self-reporting through subjective experience. And that's one reason why some of the scientists who study this are very interested in, let's say, meditators, because they have a long history of talking about what's going on in the brain. You know, they are practiced to observe their own minds and then to talk about it. And, you know, so is there some way that you could combine that kind of personal insight with the tools of science? Is that all part of science? I mean, it's a really interesting question. Is that science, or have you left science at that point?
All right, you're getting into a whole fuzzy area there that I bet a lot of scientists are not very comfortable with.
Yeah, I think, but there are some. And so, Richard Davidson here on the University of Wisconsin campus, he's one of the leading figures in the study of kind of what would be called mindfulness and, you know, sort of trying to incorporate that more subjective experience into along with the tools of brain science. But, you know, there are open questions about how far you can go with that.
Well, so on the other thing in that clip, at the end there, he's talking about how consciousness may just be this fundamental property of our physical world. Now, so wait.
That is a really radical idea.
Let me see if I even understand what he's saying. So is he kind of saying that consciousness could be like gravity? It's just a law.
Yeah.
And
except for it's not gravity. It's nothing. I mean, the thing that is, you know, when you think about, you know, what's the world made of? You know, you start, and then you think about, you know, there's biology, the laws of biology, and then there's chemistry, and then ultimately everything comes down to physics, right? You know, atoms and, you know, the forces of physics and gravity and, you know, attractions of different kinds of things. And what he is saying, and he's not alone. I mean, Chalmers is along with some other people saying, you know, maybe consciousness just can't be explained by any of that stuff, any of the existing laws of physics. Maybe it's something else. And that's crazy. You know, what is that made of? I mean, it's just maybe you can't even talk about what it's made of. Maybe it's just it's some distinct kind of thing. And then now Chalmers himself is not a religious believer. I'm not sure that he would describe himself as being a particularly spiritual person. But a lot of people who have a spiritual bent kind of run with that idea. And they say, oh, you know, maybe consciousness is kind of a thing in itself. And then that might explain why you can't just sort of reduce it to one person's individual brain. Maybe there's sort of consciousness out there that, you know, that we can tap, you know, some sort of a collective consciousness. And, you know, again, we've left science at this point, but it's, you know, it's pretty interesting stuff.
I don't know if I've had enough coffee for this conversation. So maybe we could listen to one that's easy to wrap your head around as we go into the break here. This is hilarious. Now we're getting outside of the heavy duty hardcore thinky stuff that we've been listening to. And this is Karen
Slavik-Leonard. Sure. And this is an interview that Jim Fleming did. And this is she a few years ago, she's an American who married a British guy, and she discovered that he talks in his sleep. And he says the craziest stuff. In fact,
yeah, and he's evil.
Well, in fact, a lot of what he says in his sleep, we could not play on the radio. It turns out he has a very foul mouth. And so she started a blog, and then the blog went viral, and then she wrote a book called Sleep Talkin' Man. And here is a little excerpt from that interview.
Adam is lovely. He's humble. He's kind and respectful, and Sleep Talking Man is exactly the opposite of all of those things.
As a matter of fact, I think maybe this is a good time to hear some of what he says. Well, there's one when he talks about an army of runner ducks. Let's listen.
Oh, yeah. There's my army of runner ducks. And they take over the world. With a waddle and a quack. And a waddle and a quack. I kind of rule this world.
I really love that. But for listeners who couldn't quite understand it, what he's saying is, with my army of runner ducks, I'm going to take over the world. With a waddle and a quack, and a waddle and a quack, I'm going to rule this world. Yeah.
So this is a kind of recurring theme. Animals, we hear lots about chickens and badgers and hippos and...
Oh, and there's a thing or two in the course of things about guinea pigs. They seem to pop up regularly, don't they?
Yes, they do.
We have one more that I'd like to end with. It's Adam claiming to be Mediterranean man.
Mediterranean man. Hear my cry. Tzatziki! And tremble with fear. I will cut you with my throwing pita.
I will cut you with my throwing pita.
And I love the war cry of Tzatziki. I love it. He does sound, I mean, he sounds formidable. I don't know if I would be comfortable being married to this man. But I guess the point here is look at the slippery little byways the yes. brain can lead us yeah. down.
Well, and I mean, obviously, the world of the unconscious is a very strange place. And you know, there's always that sort of that, you know, interesting line, what separates consciousness from the unconscious? And that's just kind of a little glimpse into that world.
So where is that coming from? I mean,
that's a profound question. Who knows? And, you know, sleep takes us into all kinds of different areas.
Do you talk in your sleep?
I do not talk in my sleep.
It's disappointing. No, no. I'd love to hear what your war cry would be.
Well, and it's, I mean, you could respond to, you know, some people might be kind of freaked out if they heard their husband.
I, for one.
And her response, she said she has insomnia often. So she's, you know, her husband is sleeping next to her, you know, and she thinks it's funny. It's sort of like, you know, he's almost keeping her company, you know, while she's still awake. And, you know, he's saying all this weird stuff. And so at a certain point, she got out her little recorder and thought, gee, you know, I should tape some of this stuff.
I'm keeping company with an evil pita despot. But other than that. Well, we're talking this hour about consciousness with Steve Paulson. Probably recognize the name from WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge. He's the executive producer. And he is also the producer of the new TT book series, Meet Your Mind. It's got 6 parts, and you can listen online at WPR.org or TTbook.org. And we welcome your questions and your comments for Steve this morning about the emerging science of consciousness. Steve knows an awful lot about it. He has been studying it for years, and of course, hence the radio series. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Friday on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I hope you'll stick around next hour as we ask internationally known vegan and best-selling author John Robbins for the skinny on food issues, like the rise of food contamination and the slave trade behind chocolate and coffee. That's coming up after 10 o'clock. This hour, we're talking consciousness with Steve Paulson here from Wisconsin Public Radio. He's the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge and the producer of the new series Meet Your Mind. It's a 6-part series on consciousness. And we've been listening to a bunch of clips from that series. And we'll go ahead and dig into some of these phone calls now. We have Jeff on the line from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, this is fascinating. And I'm not even sure exactly how to phrase this question, but you were talking about the fellow who believes consciousness may be a fundamental principle and perhaps even outside the brain. We know the brain can exist without consciousness, but he's saying the reverse is true. And I'm wondering, in your discussions with these folks, did they get into at all this idea that Kurzweil and others have talked about evolution, various moments of evolution, and how currently the universe is just a long process of information organizing itself, becoming more organized, and this whole idea that we may be the last biological beings here as we become more, I hate to say it, digital. But are they connected at all?
Yes, they are. Well, and in fact, in the hour that's coming up this weekend, we have an interview with Ray Kurzweil. And so he is talking about, he has this theory called the singularity, that as time marches on, as science becomes more advanced with the combination of nanotechnology and bioengineering and computer technology, that essentially there will be more what you might call mechanical parts that are put inside our brains. We'll have tiny little nanobots in our brains, he thinks that over time, the non-biological parts of our brains will become ever greater, and sort of the actual neurons, the biological stuff in our brains, sort of would become less and less, and that we will become, it would sort of be this merging of machine and human. And he threw out a date a while back. I don't know if he still sticks to this date, that the singularity will happen, and I think it's the year 2045. Watch out.
They should never throw out dates.
Yeah. So he has a pretty good track record as an inventor and a futurist. And so some of his dates have worked in the past. I mean, there are a lot of assumptions in that theory, which is that to some degree, you can kind of crack the mysteries of consciousness. It's all a mechanical process. You can sort of, you know, put in your computer technology and sort of have it merge with the neural connections and, you know, create a new sense of consciousness. And I know some people are dubious about that. A lot of people are dubious about that, in fact.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your question, Jeff. I don't know. How do you feel about that? I mean, I know obviously you're a journalist and you have your objective experience with this, but
oh, I have plenty of subjective ideas too.
How do you feel about the idea of nanobots running around your head, changing your consciousness?
It makes me kind of nervous. You know, I mean, it raises these huge questions of what does it mean to be human? But the thing is, I mean, the other way to look at it is we already use all kinds of technologies. You know, I wear glasses because my eyes aren't very good. So, you know, that's, you know, augments my experience of the world. Or think about people who have problems hearing, have cochlear implants. I mean, so it's amazing, you know, what the technologies can do to enhance life experience. And this is taking it a step further. And I mean, the thing that kind of creeps me out a little bit is when people start to say that, and as Kurzweil does, there will be a time when, you know, we will basically spend large parts of our lives in virtual worlds. And, you know, we'll be able to create our own worlds out there. And, you know, maybe we don't really like who we are. We can create a different persona who interacts in the world out there. And, you know, and it also raises questions about, you know, if we are mostly machine more than human down the road. You know, what is that? You know, how long do we live? You know, what does death mean anymore? You know, are we limited to the constraints of biological longevity? And, you know, again, those are profound questions, and there's would be an awful lot of science to do before we get to that point. And, you know, can we even? I mean, those are tough questions.
And what would that virtual world look like? If it looks like Second Life, it's not a big sell, you know?
Well, I mean,
you kind of want how deeply rich and real are these worlds going to be?
Theoretically, you could make it whatever you'd want.
Now, what is this? Wasn't there something, the holodeck on Star Trek? Remember, they used to be able to enter these different worlds. And that seems pretty seductive. Some of Kurzweil's stuff. How was he received by his fellow scientists?
I think he's respected by scientists. I think, you know, it comes down to there are some people who are more enamored by computers as a model for how the brain works. And, you know, artificial intelligence has been a big part of these debates about consciousness. And so people who work in that area probably would be more favorably disposed to what Kurzweil is saying. And other people would say that, you know, really the human brain is not like a computer at all. And I think they would reject some of his analogies.
Well, thank you much for that call. And let's head next to Michael, who is joining us from Linksville. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, my idea of that the universe is very analogous to the brain is completely indifferent to what you just said as far as computers being analogous to the brain. And I'm actually interested in, have you found any research that shows that the places that the brain can go consciously through the psychopharmaceuticals available from the soil, such as mushrooms, peyote, cannabis, all these things that people are now peering into further and further with science, matching it. Have you done any or seen any light shed on that as far as humanity and where consciousness may go and the evolution of the DNA of the human? So that's my question.
Actually, yes, I have. It's another one of my interests, actually. I mean, there's a really interesting science of psychedelics or of hallucinogens. And, you know, there's a fascinating history of this, which goes back. And I might just add that, in fact, we have, and also this coming hour, this coming weekend on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we have an interview with Stanislav Grof, who's one of the founders of research on LSD. And he's actually originally from Czechoslovakia. He was doing his research 10 years before Timothy Leary ever started his famous LSD studies. And Grof is kind of one of the founders of this. And there's a serious science that has studied these kinds of things. And then what happened was in the 60s with Timothy Leary, things got crazy, out of control. A lot of these psychedelics, which are incredibly powerful, were used recklessly. And basically they were shunned. And then the scientists who were studying this, they kind of had to either just stop or go underground. And just in the last, 5 to 10 years or so, I would say there are a few scientists here and there who have gone back and are, again, studying certain psychedelics like LSD or psilocybin. And they are often looking for therapeutic uses. And so, for instance, there have been studies of people who have terminal cancer and who have profound fear of death. And they have found in some of these studies that if they take these under very controlled clinical settings, that they come to terms with their death in easier ways. I mean, it helps. And then
is it because these experiences sort of crack the universe open for them and make them feel as though there's much more than this finite body?
I think that is true, yes.
Maybe like a religious experience of sorts.
Well, and then there's a scientist at Johns Hopkins, a guy named Roland Griffiths, who has had people come into his lab and take psilocybin. And he has found that, I don't remember the percentage off the top of my head, but something like a quarter of the people talked about this experience they had as being one of the 4 or 5 most profound experiences of their life. And they often talk about it as a mystical experience. And so there are all kinds of questions about, you know, what's that about? And, you know, you can read this in different ways. You can say, well, this is, you know, it's tapping something in our brains that sort of, you know, takes us off in different directions. Some people would say it takes us to a dimension that really cannot be explained by our, you know, our individual brains, that maybe you're tapping something more universal. So there definitely are people who have spiritual readings there.
It will be interesting to see how the study of consciousness evolves and tangles up with religion as we know it and the science or just the belief people have in the soul, and whether it weakens it or strengthens it and how that evolves. But there are even people like Sam Harris, you call him the world's most famous atheist, and he is not even willing to rule out the possibility that consciousness could survive death.
Yeah. Well, just a slight correction. I would probably call Richard Dawkins the world's most famous atheist, but Harris is perhaps the most prominent American atheist. And he's, I mean, the usual take you would get from atheists on this question of consciousness is, yeah, the mind is a product of what the brain does. Harris is interesting from a couple of perspectives. One, he's a neuroscientist, so he really knows brain science. He also is a longtime meditator. I mean, he has gone on meditation retreats for 20 hours at a time. So he's extremely familiar with Eastern traditions of contemplative practice. And he, when I interviewed him, he astonished me. He talked about having had telepathic experiences, you know, not the usual thing that you hear from an atheist. And so we have a little excerpt here where he is speculating on the difficulties of cracking the consciousness puzzle.
There are good reasons to be skeptical of the naive conception of a soul. And so the idea that the brain can die and a soul that still speaks English and recognizes granny is going to float away into the afterlife, that seems to be profoundly implausible. And yet we do not know what the relationship between subjectivity and objectivity ultimately is. And for instance, you know, we could be living in a universe where consciousness goes all the way down to the bedrock, so that there is some interior subjective dimension to an electron, say.
That's interesting, though, because most evolutionary biologists, I mean, particularly thinking the secular ones, would say, of course, consciousness cannot survive the brain. It will not survive death. You are not willing to make that claim.
Yeah, I just don't know. If we were living in a universe where consciousness survived death in some sense, or just transcended the brain so that, you know, single neurons were conscious, we would not expect to see it by our present techniques of neuroimaging or cellular neuroscience, and we would never expect to see it. There are profound philosophical and epistemological problems that anyone must confront who's trying to reduce consciousness to the workings of the brain, and this discourse is in its infancy, and who knows where it's going to go.
Yeah, that's just fascinating to hear Sam Harris,
right. I know,
deliver words like that. It struck me, though, that just talking about consciousness is a problem. Now, he used the phrase that it may turn out that there is, quote, an interior subjective dimension to an electron.
Right.
I don't know what that means.
I'm not sure that I do either.
I don't even know if I can conceptualize that. I mean, is he, I don't know, explain that to me, Steve. How would there be an interior subjective dimension to an electron? Does that mean you get down to a piece of matter that we think we know, and then there is something ineffable about it after all?
Well, matter itself is kind of ineffable when you get down to the quantum level. And I'm not a quantum scientist. I'm a journalist.
You're just a radio producer.
I'm just a radio producer. You have it. But, you know, what they've discovered, of course, about, you know, at that subatomic level, at the quantum level, electrons don't have fixed positions. You know, there's sort of the, you know, if you actually sort of try to, you're entering the realm of probability there, you know, when you get to quantum science. And if you're trying to pinpoint where things exactly are, you can be very precise about how often the electrons will be in a particular place. But it's matter actually gets a little ethereal at that deep level. Getting back to what Sam Harris is talking about, I mean, some people probably usually with a more mystical bent talk about there being the consciousness is the inside of the universe. Something to think about. As opposed to the outside of the universe being the stuff that science can measure.
Consciousness is the inside of the universe. Explain that more. What would that mean?
I don't know if I can explain it more. It's
the stuff you can't see?
No, consciousness is how we experience the world. So, I mean, we all have this some sense of consciousness. I mean, you and I right now, presumably you are conscious and I am conscious right now. And so, I mean, we're intimately familiar with that. But where does that come from? Again, I'm not saying that I would accept this idea that, you know, consciousness is at the inside of the universe. I'm just saying it's an idea out mm-hmm. there that some people
sure.
have floated. And what they're basically saying is that, you know, if science can't explain it, and, you know, the hypothesis, maybe science will never be able to explain it. So where do you go with it? I mean, how do you talk about that at that point? I mean, I think that's what they're referring to. And then, you know, there's a kind of spiritual dimension where people would say that, say, the great mystics would be tapping that inside of the universe.
Well, and you have Deepak Chopra, someone you speak to in this series, and he says, you know, maybe there is going to be a scientific explanation for the soul, but there still will be a soul. It sounds like he thinks it's based in quantum mechanics. Do I have that remotely right?
You do, and this is highly speculative, and it's something that some people with more of a spiritual bent will say, well, you know, quantum physics is the place to go to explain consciousness, and it's purely speculation. I mean, there's really no scientific proof for that, and quantum physics is a big mystery. I think, you know, physicists would say that as well, but that's highly speculative. But that is a certain strain of thinking that people like Deepak Chopra talk about.
It seems as though if you wanted to, you could kind of parcel all of this up and slap a label on it that labeled it experiments to prove or disprove God, in a way. I mean,
I actually wouldn't go there. I think that, well, I mean, take someone like Sam Harris, who is open to the idea that consciousness could exist independently of an individual's brain. He doesn't believe in God. So I think often those match up, the people who would say that consciousness is ineffable and, you know, science will never be able to explain it. Yes, they often, you know, have a religious bent, but it's not necessarily the same thing.
But you don't think if, Daniel Dennett, that was his name, right?
Mm-hmm.
If he were to be correct and he were able to exactly prove why consciousness
mm-hmm.
works and exists
mm-hmm.
and is right present for all of us, you don't think that if he proved that, it wouldn't also weaken to a great degree religion?
I think it would undercut, some people's belief in religion, absolutely. And, I mean, one of the big questions, I mean, there is kind of a vigorous science of trying to explain religious belief right now. And so, I mean, again, I mean, people are looking at different parts of the brain and sort of trying to figure out, so what, you know, what is triggered in the brain when people talk about having religious experiences? And there are some people who worry that if you could really explain that totally,
then sort of, you know, the validity of that belief is undercut. And I think that's an open question whether that's true or not. I think it would certainly give more ammunition to the atheists who would say that it's just all brain chemistry.
Well, we're talking this hour with Steve Paulson. He is the executive producer, one of the founders of To the Best of Our Knowledge, and he has recently produced a 6-part series that we're discussing this hour. It's called Meet Your Mind, and there's a couple hours yet to air on the Wisconsin Public Radio. You can always listen online as well at ttbook.org, and we'll be talking more with him as we complete this hour and hopefully talking with you as well. You can reach us with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Friday on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 12:30, join us for Chapter a Day. Susan Sweeney reads from Ann Patchett's novel called State of Wonder. A doctor travels to the Amazon and finds extraordinary things, opening opportunities for the future and reviving the past. That's 12:30's Chapter a Day. This hour, we're speaking with Steve Paulson, TT Book Executive Producer, To the Best of Our Knowledge, here at Wisconsin Public Radio. He is the author of the book of Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. And lately, he's been getting pretty deep into consciousness. In fact, he's just produced a 6-part series on the subject, which is airing currently on Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to our callers right now. We've got Barbara, who's joining us from Sheboygan. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm fascinated in this topic, particularly from the perspective of spirituality. And one of the windows it seems to me we may have into consciousness is hypnotism. And I'm wondering if that's anything you've explored.
I haven't actually looked into hypnotism. I mean, that's an interesting question. It's I think one of the mysteries that this subject raises is what happens when you kind of when you tap the unconscious. And again, going back to what we were talking about with people who are studying psychedelics, I mean that's part of the fascination with that is, I mean, the operating theory is that, you know, when you take a psychedelic, you are tapping something that's deep within you that you don't ordinarily have access to. It's like it opens a door. And I think theoretically hypnosis would be something like that. I don't have anything more specific to say about hypnosis, except for, I mean, obviously some people who've used it have had a powerful results in terms of, you know, it helping them dealing with certain issues in their lives.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Barbara. Appreciate the call. And we'll go next to Michael in Oconomowoc. Hi there.
Hi. I have a brief comment about Kurt's Wheel and then a question. First of all, you mentioned before that you didn't quite know what a virtual world would look like, and I think basically exists on Facebook, Twitter, all those sorts of social networking that in a way is almost a virtual world in itself.
Hmm.
That and my question is related to the science of, I guess, brain science, comparing how researchers look at people with a quote-unquote normal brain compared to people with some sort of mental disability or some sort of chemical imbalance, and I wonder how those two things are looked at differently, I guess.
Those are big questions there. Following up on the first question about social media, it's an interesting question how you define virtual worlds. And I suppose in some sense, I mean, if you define a virtual world as something that's removed from your physical world, I mean, what people like Ray Kurzweil are talking about is a much more extreme version of a virtual world. I mean, he's talking about basically your mind is, you're totally in another dimension that often that you have created yourself. I mean, you have sort of set out the parameters for that. And it could be anything. I mean, you could change your sense of self through that. You could change the world that you're dealing with. So it's, you know, you're not just limited to, you know, the physical world around you. You could potentially create any kind of world. So, I mean, that's a much more extreme version. And in terms of the question about people with neurological disorders, I mean, certainly there is research on that. And I mean, one of the things that we talk about some in fact, it's another interview in the show that's coming up this weekend, is people who are autistic savants. And some of them have been studied, have gone into laboratories. And I mean, these are people who, I mean, often they have difficulty articulating that experience. There are a few who are good at describing it. Maybe the most famous one is Daniel Tammet. And he's featured in our program. And then there are other experiences, people who have what is called acquired savant syndrome. So that, and these are truly strange cases that, I mean, really hard to explain, where people would be, I mean, sometimes they have, they might be autistic or have severe neurological problems. And I mean, there's one case of a guy named Leslie Lemke, actually from Wisconsin, and psychiatrist Daryl Treffert has known him, has worked with him for years. He had no musical training, and then he heard, I think it was it a symphony at the age of 12 or something like that? And then he went and sat down at the piano and played it from memory pretty much perfectly the first time.
Whew.
How do you explain that? I mean, that's just, it's as if he's tapping into some part of the brain that, you know, that ordinarily we, you know, we have no idea how to do that. Dr. Treffert's theory is that all of us have this capacity sort of underneath kind of our, I don't know, you would say consciousness, I guess, that, you know, if we knew how to tap into something more primal, we could unleash certain creative powers.
Sounds like you're kind of talking about the inside of the universe again.
Yeah, sort of, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really gets interesting when you dig into this stuff.
Let's see. Let's go to an email from Brandon. Steve has had several sections of the book on psychedelics and new research being done, and also the spiritual side of these substances. We've talked some about this. But could he please comment on his own personal experiences, if any, with such chemicals and what they did to him? And Steve, you have an ayahuasca trip coming up, right?
No, I don't. You know, I really don't have anything to report there. Can I take the personal question in a different direction?
Sure.
I mean, this is sort of a fascinating story. We had a family vacation in France this last year, and we went to one of the things that we did. I turned one day into a radio piece that's part of the series. We went to two of the ancient French caves with old cave paintings. You know, famously Lascaux and Chauvet, you know, these cave paintings that are, you know, tens of thousands of years old. And so we found there are the most famous caves are closed to the public. You can't go in, but there are a few smaller privately owned caves. And so we went into a couple, and it was an amazing experience to see paintings that were done 15,000 years ago that were astonishingly good.
Hmm.
I mean,
so you're not talking about the crude caveman Flintstone style.
Oh, no. No, this is, well, Picasso famously said when he first saw the paintings at Lascaux, he said, "I've met my master." We have learned nothing since.
Really?
They're phenomenally good. And, I mean, the artistry in, well, this one cave we went to, Ruffignac, it was, and as our guide was saying, you know, if you made a mistake in there, you couldn't redo it. You know, so there was this series of, for instance, outlines of mammoth caves, and they were exquisite. And it was just sort of like, and, you know, what evolutionary biologists would say is that, you know, our brains really have not evolved that much in, let's say, the last 15 or 20,000 years. I mean, those people were us, essentially, even though the technology has changed dramatically. So, I mean, it was just sort of like that. It was eye opening. It was just, wow, what, you know, this is amazing.
So how was working on this series sort of made you think differently about your own brain? I mean, it's sort of one of those twisty mind puzzles. You think about thinking, and how do you do that? And once you've done that, you're kind of down the rabbit hole already if you're trying to think about thinking. I mean, I guess this is in a way what religions do, and some of the guests in your programs talk about this. But for you personally, how does it make you think about your own consciousness?
I probably have a couple of responses to that. One is I'm just a very intellectually curious person, and so I'm always kind of wrestling with ideas of what science can tell us about. And so there's that level. There's the level of, we haven't really talked about mindfulness and what a lot of people would say is, I mean, you can to some degree, I don't want to say control consciousness, but you can modify it. You can kind of be calmer. You can learn to be happier through meditation. I mean, I guess one of my takeaways is, you know, it's time for me to start meditating, which I don't do. And I've talked to enough people who say, you know, this is really helpful. And, you know, one of the things about mindfulness is the brain is very plastic. And, you know, what you think about can actually rewire your brain to some degree.
All right. Well, next time we see you, you'll be a meditating Steve Paulson.
We'll see.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fantastic.
Oh, it's been fun.
Steve Paulson, executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge and producer of the new series Meet Your Mind. You can find it at ttbook.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.